Like the hills of Snowdonia, the rugged coastline of Cornwall was formed on the equator millions of years ago when muddy deposits turned into sedimentary rock. Volcanic activity produced superheated steam infused with minerals such as tin, copper, and zinc. It forced itself into cracks and fractures in the cliffs, and as it cooled, the steam crystallized, leaving deposits of copper and tin ore. These have been quarried by Cornish miners for hundreds of years and have inspired innovations which have helped to shape our world. I'm John Sargent, and this is People's Landscapes, a podcast from the National Trust which explores how people, places and cultures have come together. In this four-part series, we will discover what connects Ice Age floods and the dialects we speak, how geological events can form the bedrock of community or become the driving force behind neighbourhood feuds. In this final episode, we join Trust archaeologist James Parry as he explores how West Country mining innovation made Cornwall the Silicon Valley of the 1800s and helped spread Cornish culture to some very unexpected places.
As an archaeologist, we're fascinated with understanding the connections between people and place. Sometimes it's objects that tell these stories. Sometimes these stories are pretty straightforward and self-evident. Other times they can pose some really interesting questions. One such example is a recent discovery that came up during a road widening project in a small town called Camborne in Cornwall.
My name is Ainsley Cox. I'm the Research and Information Officer with the Cornwall and West Devon Mining Landscape World Heritage Site team. Some years ago now, some building works were taking place at Tucking Mill, which is a small settlement on the edge of Camborne. An old commercial waste tip was excavated as part of that. One of the local contractors, he spotted something shiny in the waste and took it home and cleaned it up and realised it was a cup, a presentation cup, with an inscription on it which said Sam Ham being presented for Cornish wrestling.
Nothing out of the ordinary there. Cornish wrestling is a style of wrestling that is quite niche but is practised in this area. However, the next bit of the engraving was a little bit more confusing. It said the trophy had been awarded to Sam in a tournament that took place somewhere called Manor House in Jeppestown, South Africa. There's only a few people that still practice this wrestling in Cornwall. So why was there a Cornish wrestling tournament happening thousands of miles away? And why was the trophy buried under the road? To understand some of the backstory to Sam Ham's Cup, you have to go back some 3,000 years in the history of mining. So I'm walking on the clifftops here in West Penwith, in the sort of far southwest of Cornwall on its north coast. You might be more familiar with these from the more recent episodes of Poldark. The cliffs are pretty steep and rugged as they're battered by the Atlantic. As you walk along the cliffs, if you're lucky, something you can still see today along the cliff faces are these greenish stains. And these are some of the first clues as to the mystery of Sam's Cup.
Copper tends to create a green residue. Thousands of years ago, people could see these going down the cliff edge. You could dig a pit to see if there was anything near the surface. Copper on its own is easily worked because it is soft. But when tin production became known more widely from the Bronze Age onwards, then you got the opportunity to mix that with copper to form bronze. Bronze is a much harder material, much more useful for cutting-edge implements, for weapons, swords, knives, shields, that kind of thing. In the later period, copper was used extensively for the copper bottoming of ships. Bronze is very much an important part of machine bearings. So it found lots and lots of other uses, which were very, very important to the Industrial Revolution in Britain.
So as I walk around the corner here, I'm coming to the site of Levant Mine, that was extracting copper and tin ore in its heydays in the 1800s. And I've come to find out more about how the place worked, how the technology developed, which ended up driving industry far across the world. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Richard, what do you do here then?
I'm a tour guide, so I try and explain what's not here. In other words, the buildings and all the bits and pieces that were once a massive industrial complex, but now there's just ruins.
As you say, you know, what we see on the surface is probably a minuscule element of what really the business of Cornish mining was all about. And this mine map on the wall, it looks like a bit like a Pac-Man maze or something like that.
Yeah, indeed.
Sort of shafts going down and adits going across. Can you tell us a little bit more about it?
So this is probably a representation of something towards the latter part of the 19th century. And it does give you an idea of all the levels that were going down. 1,668 feet and outwards, well over a mile out to sea. There is a story in about the 1860s that the men were working out there and they could hear clonks and bumps above their heads. And they attributed that to boulders being rolled about by the ocean currents.
Oh my goodness. This originally started off at only relatively few levels going down.
The early mines were basically just tunnels driven into the cliffs. Very small operation, perhaps a dozen men.
We're obviously starting off with some pretty basic
manually
driven technology here.
Yeah, hammer and chisel.
How do they suddenly get from working with those kind of tools to what must be sort of technologically quite a feat to start going to the depths we're talking about here?
If you want, I'll go and take you to the entrance tunnel that was dug and see how it was created.
So Richard, we've come down these spiral stairs. We're now disappearing down into a passageway.
Indeed. This is the entrance to the mine.
Those really shallow levels that we first saw, I'm guessing, is very similar to what we're seeing immediately beneath our feet here.
Yeah.
So if I slip down to this platform,
yeah.
Rather amazing vertical drop, and I can hear permanent sound of water.
We're not too far underground at the minute, and there's still water, so by the time we get deep down, there's going to be an awful lot of water, because of course it builds up, and that was the limiting factor. In the early days, they were confined to low-level, shallow mining, slightly uphill, so the water would run down and out, and this was one of the big problems. We had to move the water. As they started to dig deeper, they lifted it out in barrels. Way back in Tudor times, you had two men winching it up like a well. As the quantity of water got greater, of course, you'd lift out barrels of water and you would use something called a horse whim. So that would be the stage from using gravity in a tunnel, men, to using a horse with a horse whim. So when the mine got so deep, so much time is being used lifting water, they decide they've got to do something about it and they start pumping the water out using a steam engine.
Richard Trevithick and other local Cornish engineers created the whole concept of what became known as the Cornish engine, and it became known not just locally in Cornwall or in the UK, but internationally, and for a spell of about 50 years. If you wanted the most efficient pumping engine you could get, you came to Cornwall for that. So in essence, it developed into a Silicon Valley almost, where this particular technology was at the cutting edge. It's difficult to look at modern-day Cornwall, perhaps, in that gaze.
One of the most exciting things about this site here at Levant is not only the loving restoration that's gone into the buildings, but that the engine house also has a fully working steam engine. We're going to come and meet Ray, who's the font of all knowledge of engines. Nice to meet you, Ray.
Pleased to meet you, sir.
With this amazing selection of levers and wheels, can you show me how the engine works? Ready?
Yep.
I mean, this is something out of sort of like childhood storybooks. You feel pretty small compared to the size of the machinery around it. Please tell us a little bit more about the amazing engineering that went into these Cornish engines.
The Cornish had a serious problem down here, that the price of coal was absolutely exorbitant, which meant that the designers of the engines had a lot of pressure from the users to reduce their costs. An engineer called Richard Trevithick, he designed in those days what was a very, very efficient boiler. And because of that, the engine designers could then use that to make engines which either became smaller or became more powerful. But at the end of the day, they used less coal, which then allowed them to go much deeper and continue with the mine being a very profitable operation for the mine owners.
With the increasing production of copper and tin during the 19th century, there was a drive for a larger workforce. Small rural communities gave way to developments like St Just and larger towns like Campbell and Redruth and St Agnes. During the early 1800s, Cornwall was an epicentre of mining expertise and technical innovation, people migrating here from across the UK and around the world.
Thousands of people were employed in the mining industry, but there were also thousands more in the spin-off industries.
The influx of greater numbers would have brought all sorts of different cultural elements with them.
Mines, in some instances, would have their own football teams, and the same with rugby, I guess. Cornish wrestling was a very important part of the suite of leisure pursuits, all part of a kind of the rich tapestry of how mining bound people together, I guess. Other individuals were drawn to Cornwall, particularly in the areas of academic study. It sort of acted as a spur for those researching geology.
Pioneering industrialists started to apply these technological innovations and acquired expertise to make their fortunes overseas.
Steam pumping engines went right around the world, onto the continent, to South Africa, South Australia, North America, Latin America, Mexico. John Taylor and Sons started a company in the early 1820s. They sent out parties of Cornish mine workers and Cornish mining equipment on vessels. Via a very difficult means, they made the 250-mile trip inland to the elevated area of Pachuca and Real del Monte. After being abandoned through the Mexican War of Independence, silver mines, prior to that war, those silver mines had been extremely lucrative. But once the Spanish were effectively ejected from the country, then that opened up the land for British capital and Cornish labour and skills to be applied to rehabilitate those defunct silver mines.
But it was this success which also contributed to the downfall of the Cornish mining industry, as pioneering industrialists started to apply these technological innovations and acquired expertise to make their fortunes overseas.
The market prices for metals internationally went down because it became much more readily available. New mines are shallow, old mines are deep. Cornish mines perhaps being in production for 200 or more years in some instances, whereas newly developing mines overseas, they're probably shallow, the ore is perhaps richer as well, there's less costs around that, and you've got many, many more mines in many, many areas, so that made it difficult for Cornwall to continue competing economically, so many mines shut, you know, from the 1860s onwards. The modes and methods of mining migration that had been established in the early decades of the 19th century were then put to greater use in the closing decades of the century because the mine working employment just wasn't available to the degree that it had been hitherto. Many mine workers would use those established links to get a toehold in an area elsewhere, just as migrants go to different countries today.
The migration of Cornish culture can be seen around the world in countries such as South and Western Australia and North and South America.
I had the good fortune to visit Mexico twice in the 2000s. The city today is called Pachuca, and the nearby smaller town is called Real del Monte or Mineral del Monte. It's quite incongruous when you see a Cornish engine house that looks like it could be in Redruth or at St Just on a hillside overlooking Pachuca. And there it is, you know, in all its glory, and it's still standing. And that's quite remarkable, because it's a weird juxtaposition. The Dolores mine has a plaque on it which says, here the first game of soccer was played. There are photographs which show that team when they were actually playing at the time. That introduction of football to Mexico developed into what is today the Pachuca football team, which is a bit like the Manchester United of Mexican football, and you can see so all of that came about because a certain concentration, a certain number of mine workers from Cornwall were out there at that time.
In South Africa, there's one particular Cornish mining community which establishes itself in a town called Jeppestown, just outside Johannesburg. There is a hotel and a sports bar called the Manor House, where one sport in particular is especially popular, Cornish wrestling.
I believe it was some form of sports bar that the mine workers would have frequented at the time. We did some research which identified the hotel, and I think we essentially identified probably the room within which the wrestling competition took place.
Our research suggests that it's the same bar where Sam Hamm won the trophy.
He was quite a local figure in Cornish wrestling generally, who went out to South Africa towards the end of the 19th century to work in the mining fields out there. Sam was out there for a certain number of years, so he had plenty of time to sort of get embedded in the local sports activities and so forth.
But what's more of a mystery is how the cup ended up buried under the road.
We've speculated, though we have no proof to this, that Sam Hamm or his family were burgled at some stage in the past, and that as part of the takings, this cup was one of those. And somebody probably looked at it and thought, well, this is not solid silver. Obviously, it had somebody's name on it, so they didn't want any kind of identification. So somehow or other, it got thrown away, and that's why it probably ended up in the domestic waste tip where it was eventually found. But again, the whole story is quite bizarre in lots of ways. In the chances that kind of sort of brought us to it, or brought it to us, perhaps.
The story behind Sam Hamm's cup is a fascinating one, and it's amazing what the personal story can bring to our understanding of a landscape. However, when you do look at this wider landscape, there's an amazing and very intricate history of how people have learned to adapt and survive and expand beyond their immediate surroundings.
To learn more about this podcast and other audio programs from the National Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. The People's Landscapes podcast is part of a year-long programme of events, exhibitions and debates inspired by the 200-year anniversary of the Peterloo Massacre in Manchester. Today, as the crowds mill around Peter Street or sip afternoon tea in the city's Midland Hotel, most visitors are blissfully unaware of the dramatic events that took place here 200 years ago. In the same spirit, we invite you to look beyond the beauty and familiarity of your favourite National Trust properties and take a deep dive into their surprising and hidden histories. To learn more about the events and exhibitions associated with People's Landscapes, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/People's Landscapes.